there are days they seem so far away. But you gotta believe me when I tell you that tomorrow's gonna be a better day. Night may fall, but again the sun will rise. And all you gotta do is just look into my eyes and see that I believe in you. I know there's nothing you can't do. Just give it some.
From Deerhoof.
Yeah. You are listening to
WMFO in Medford.
Yeah.
You hope no home of no family.
WMFO, Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there's no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning. It's the 13th of February. 2019. It's the first day of baseball. Pitchers and catchers are showing up for the most part for most teams today or tomorrow. So to start the show, I'm going to play the 1934 All-Star Game. So that's going to bookend. I'll play out the end of the show with that as well. We'll just let that play on through. But I'm going to have episode 6 from Destination Freedom, part 2 of the story of Frederick Douglass. That'll be coming up probably in about 15 minutes or so. I've got a couple of trainees here, so I'm going to be working with them while the All-Star Game's playing. So I hope you enjoy this. You probably won't. The quality's kind of... quality's kind of shoddy in some parts, but it is rather interesting. Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth bat third and fourth. So, hope you enjoy.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. Today we're out at the Polo Grounds, that historic old home of the New York Giants, nestled in the lee of Coogan's Bluff on the island of Manhattan. The occasion, of course, is the playing of the second annual All-Star Baseball game between the outstanding performers of the National and the American League. And boy, what an aggregation of ball tossers are wandering around there, down there on that field right now. The pick of the world, no question about that. The crowd is tremendous, the stands are packed all the way around. If you don't know the Polo Grounds, I'll just tell you quickly that it is a double-decked affair running about four-fifths to five-sixths of the way around the entire enclosure. There's only a small part of the grounds out in center field, which is devoted to the bleachers. The rest is all double-decked grandstands. The grass looks as though it were absolutely as fine as the finest type of golf course green. It's perfect out there today, and Henry Fabian has certainly done a great job. Every seat in the house is filled now, almost at least. I can't see any vacant seats anyplace from my place up here in the second tier off third base. It's just about a capacity crowd right now, and undoubtedly every inch of the standing room will be taken before game time, which is in just a little less than 15 minutes. The boys have drawn an absolutely perfect day for baseball. Not too hot, but it's plenty hot enough to get a good sweat up when you're working out there on the field, but not too hot and not hot enough to be uncomfortable for the spectators, the customers. So it's just perfect all the way around. There's a slight breeze blowing, but not enough to affect fly balls in particular. You know, last year, the first of these All-Star games was played out at Comiskey Field in Chicago, and that ended with a victory for the younger league, the Americans, the final score being 4-0. That day, a young fellow who had his 20th birthday in big league baseball only the day before yesterday, and who intends to quit as a regular at the end of this season. He broke up that ball game with a towering home run with a man on the pad. His name, as you all know, is Babe Ruth, or George Herman Ruth, if you will, and for years his specialty has been breaking up ball games. This is another year, however, and the National League is out to avenge that beating of 1933. The way that ball has been zipped around the bases so far, the dazzling infield plays both teams have been pulling off, and the great running catches of long flies the outfielders have been snagging, it seems that a man must just be a magician to slap out a safe hit. But on the other hand, when you take a look at those batting averages of the two murderers rows, you must realize that they'll just snap into it one time or another and do the necessary to score some runs. Crowd. Leading off for the American League will be Charlie Gehringer, whose second basing and 382 batting average has been one of the big reasons why the Detroit Tigers have been such thorns in the sides of the America of the New York Yankees all season. Crawling right along all the time. They've been on top once in a while, but the Yanks have managed to cross the 4th of July, which is supposed to be the old deadline, cross the 4th of July in the lead. The National batting order starts off with Frankie Frisch, the old Fordham Flash, manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. By the way, as we run along, those of you who want to take these names down, be sure to have your pencil and paper, and you can get them, and then we'll run over the batting order again a little when we finish. Thanking Fish, the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals and the captain of All-Star Nationals today, he's been camping around second base so long that that position has given up all its secrets to him. And his punch this year is at a 310 clip. Heinie Manush of the Washington Americans is second on the American batting order, and he'll be out there patrolling the left field garden. And he's the only man posting a 400 batting average. His average is 402, by the way. He'll look awful tough to those opposing pitchers. Pye Trainer, our third baseman to conjure by. He's the new Pirate manager, you know, and he'll take care of the hot corner for the Nationals. And if he can't do it, well, then just nobody can, that's all. He's hitting at a 352 clip, and he surely will play up to the great standard that he's set for years out there in Pittsburgh. Dave Ruth will be at his old right field stand for the Americans, the man with the all-time record of 699 home runs in his Major League career, and who probably has been given more intentional passes than any other man ever in baseball. For the Babe, his batting average is very puny this year, 291. The Nationals' number three man is Joe Medley, who with the Dean brothers and Frankie Frisch is largely responsible for keeping the Cardinals up near the top. He's hitting 361. The American League has chosen Lou Gehrig, Columbia Lou of the Yankees, to fill the cleanup position, and Kai Kyler of the Cubs gets the call from the Nationals. Gehrig on first is such an old institution that little need be said of him. He's baseball's Iron Man, and he's well in the running for both batting and home run leadership in his league. He's batting 369 at present. Kai Kyler is a right field ball hawk, and he sports a willow wielding average of 343 at present. Next for the Americans is Jimmy Fox. We had thought he would not be playing, but he's going to play according to the official lineup. Of course, Jimmy is a great star and home run hitter for Connie Mack down in Philadelphia. And whose first basing is just too well known to need any talking about. Fox is massaging the pellet at a 345 clip. He's playing third today for the Americans. Wally Burger, the Boston Braves center fielder, is a real ball hawk. One who gladdens the heart of Bill McKechnie, his manager, and one of the principal reasons why the Braves are always a menace. His hitting is 316. Al Simmons of the White Sox in Chicago comes next in the Americans' batting order. He'll do the center fielding. A fast, utterly graceful fly chaser and always dangerous at the plate. How many of us who were there will ever forget that athletic rally of 10 runs against the Cubs in the World Series several years ago? A rally started by Simmons' ringing home run against the left field stand. He batted twice in that inning. He's singing the ball for a 343 standing. Then we have Bill Terry on the Nationals. Memphis Bill, the manager and first backer of the Nationals. He places himself sixth in the batting order in spite of a fine average of 368, highest of the national team regulars. As everyone knows, he's also manager of the world champion New York Giants. And he's out in front now in quest of his second pennant and, of course, his second World Series. Joe Cronin of the Americans is not only manager of the team, but also manager of last year's American League champions, the Senators of Washington. Joe's pitching has fallen down on him a bit this year, but if those hurlers begin to click, as they should, his team may be right up there yet. Joe will be in there doing a lot of shortstopping, and he's much more dangerous at the plate than his 283 average might indicate in this group of terrific super sluggers. Travis Jackson of the Giants. He bats seventh for the Nationals. He's long been called the greatest shortstop in baseball, a player who seemed to be all washed up last winter on account of trouble with his legs. But trouble just doesn't mean a thing to Jackson, and he's in there with his whip-forward arm tossing runners out from any and all positions and holding up his end with the bat with an average of 287. He's one of the most opportune hitters in the game today. Behind the bat, the Americans have Bill Dickey of the Yankees, and the Nationals have Gabby Hartnett of the Cubs, both powerful forwards for their team, both possessing fine arms to intimidate potential base stealers, and both have certainly that certain something that helps and steadies pitchers at critical moments. Dickey is batting 322 right now, with Hartnett just exactly the same, so there's nothing to choose there. The backstopping will be well taken care of. Two of the truly great pitchers of today will oppose each other in the starting lineup, probably for three innings each. Senor Lefty Gomez of the Yankees and Carl Hubbell of the Giants. If these two are the starters, and I'm sure they will be now, there should be a southpaw battle for three innings at least. That'll be worth traveling mighty far to see. Gomez has already won 14 games for the Yanks, and Hubble has a rating among many who should know as the greatest living pitcher, and by not a few, as a man who is coming along to take his place as the greatest of all time. Man, also look at those batting orders. Not a soft spot from top to bottom. They're tough. Not the slightest chance for a pitching let-up. Just groove one for any man in that lot, and bang, there goes your old ball game. Will it be pitchers, or will it be hitters? A difference of opinion, eh? Well, that's what makes horse racing. Aside from the players mentioned, the Americans have, as pitchers, Red Ruffing of the Yanks, Tom Bridges of the Tigers, Mel Harder of the Indians. Tom, how's Mel going? Pretty good.
Great, man.
Tom Manning of Cleveland ought to know all about him. Jack Russell of the Senators. Infielders, Frank Higgins of the Athletics, Jimmy Dykes of the White Sox. Outfielders, Earl Everill of the Indians, Ben Chapman of the Yanks, and Sammy West of the Browns. Of course, Tom Manning thinks that both Mel Harder and Earl Averill should be right in there now in the beginning of the game. But they're not. We'll probably see them all later. Catching, Rick Farrell of the Red Sox. I'm talking about extra players now, you know. The Nationals have, as pitchers, Lon Wernicke, that great southpaw of the Cubs, Dizzy Dean, who with his brother is keeping the Cards right up near the top, Van Mungo from the Dodgers, and over in Brooklyn, they think Van Mungo is the greatest pitcher in either league, and they're not sure he is. With a lonely team this year, unfortunately, for the Dodgers, Van Mungo has been pitching great ball. Then they also have Fred Frankhouse of the Braves. It seems to be the general opinion around, among those who might know something about it, that the National League pitching will top the American League pitching today to some extent, but pretty soon we'll know all about it. As extra infielders in the Nationals, Pepper Martin of the Cards. He's that baby that went crazy and just about won a World Series all by himself a few years ago. 3 years ago, 31. Floyd Vaughn of the Pirates. We had thought that Floyd might go in playing shortstop right away as Jackson has had some eye trouble, but Jackson will start. Billy Herman of the Cubs. Outfielders for the Nationals, extra men, Paul Wehner of the Pirates. Mel Ott of the Giants and Chuck Klein of the Cubs. Just think of a baseball team that keeps Paul Wehner, Mel Ott, and Chuck Klein on the base. Boy, oh boy. Also, the extra catcher, Al Lopez of the Dodgers. The umpiring of done today will be by Brick Owens and George Moriarty from the American League, and Charlie Berman and Dolly Stott of the National League. Guidance manager Joe Cronin, the American team will have the services of Walter Johnson, the old master pitcher from Washington, you know. Walter Johnson will be on the coaching line, and Al Jack will also be on the line for the American League. And the National League team will be similarly served by manager Bill McKechnie and manager Casey Stengel. Casey Stengel, you know, I remember one day out here when Casey Stengel slapped out two home runs in a World Series, won a ball game for the Giants. What a day that was for old Casey. No doubt about that. Anyway, all together, it looks as though a grand and glorious baseball game was going to begin very, very soon. The managers of the teams, the captains of the teams, and the four umpires have gathered around the home plate for a last-minute conference before this ball game starts. I don't think there's a seat in the house. That means there must be somewhere in the neighborhood of 55,000 to 60,000 people crammed in the Polo Grounds this afternoon on one of the most beautiful baseball days you ever saw in your life. Both Gomez and Hubble are down there left-handing him into their catchers on the sidelines, getting warmed up for the game. And I want you all to know that in a few moments we'll turn the microphone over to Tom Manning of Cleveland. Tom, you know, has been telling you about World Series since time immemorial, and he's also going to give us play-by-play scoring today. Tommy Manning, that carrot-top redhead from Cleveland, Ohio. see you quit that, Tom. And also with us is Ford Bond. Ford Bond has been telling you all about the baseball scores daily through this season. And he's been making a fine baseball game out of the news results following the game. Ford has been telling you about every game. They haven't missed a game yet, have you, Ford? No, he says he hasn't missed a game. Of course, if he falls out of this box, he might miss tomorrow's game, but we'll try to keep him in. The field has been cleared now. The boys are still standing around the home plate. Joe Cronin and Bill Terry. And I see Walter Johnson is there, too. And I don't know whether it's going to be before the game or not, but I believe it will. It will be. The unveiling of the tablet for John McGraw. John McGraw, the little Napoleon, as he was called for many years. Yes, the drapes have been pulled back from the tablet commemorating the history of John McGraw and the Giants. It's out in center field. The tablet to McGraw is located just above the tomb. Or it's not the tomb, it isn't exactly a tomb, but the stone plaque out in center field at the center field exit, which was erected some years ago for that war boy, Captain Eddie Grant, formerly of the Giants. Just above the memorial to Eddie Grant is a plaque to Christy Masterson, who many people say, many of the old enthusiasts claim, was absolutely the greatest pitcher of all time.
Okay, hello, this is Madeline. I'm a trainee at WMFO, and I have a PSA. Food Not Bombs is a loose-knit group of independent collectives serving free vegan and vegetarian food to others. Food Not Bombs recovers and shares vegan or vegetarian food with the public without restriction in over 1,000 cities around the world to protest war, poverty, and the destruction of the environment. Each group is independent and invites everyone to participate in making decisions for their local chapter using the consensus process. Food Not Bombs is dedicated to taking nonviolent direct action to change society so no one is forced to stand in line to eat at a soup kitchen, expressing a commitment to the fact that food is a right and not a privilege. For more information, visit food.bombs.net. A public service message from Food Not Bombs and WMFO in Medford.
That he was not in good health. He resigned from his managership of the New York Giants, and they were his greatest love all his life. And it wasn't very long before it seemed that the body simply could not hold the soul any longer after he had lost his beloved Giants, and so he passed from us. Now this ball game is going to start in just a very few moments. And I think Tommy Manning would like to warm himself up here talking for a few moments before this baseball game commences. Tommy Manning will tell you first about the play-by-play through the entire game. Between innings, Ford Bond will talk to us and give us some of the high spots inning by inning. After the game, it'll be my pleasure to come back again on the microphone and talk about the game to some extent. Not too long, I hope. And now this is Graham McNamee speaking. The National League is the National Broadcasting Company. The National Broadcasting Company is sending you the details of this game. And here's Red Tom Manning. Come in, Tom.
Okay, that was Madeline with the PSA. You're listening to the 1934 All-Star Game, but right now I'm going to cut into Destination Freedom. This is Episode 6. The Key to Freedom is what its title. Its original air date was the 1st of August, 1948. Destination Freedom aired from the 27th of June, 1948 to the 13th of August, 1950 on WMAQ in Chicago on Sunday mornings. It was written and created by Richard Durham, an African-American writer whose credits would run the gamut, according to the Encyclopedia of Old Time Radio. What also makes Destination Freedom interesting was it had an all African-American repertoire company other than all white cast vernacularizing black language. So this is part two. The first one was Key to Freedom. This one is, wait, No. For last week, I played The Making of a Man. This one is The Key to Freedom, but it is. It's the story of Frederick Douglass. This is Arthur. You're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free.
Destination, freedom. The Chicago Defender and station WMAQ bring you Destination Freedom, a new radio series dramatizing the great democratic traditions of the Negro people, interwoven in the pageant of history and a part of America's own Destination Freedom. Today, Destination Freedom brings you the second and last chapter in the story of Frederick Douglass, outstanding editor and leading abolitionist during the Civil War. The chapter entitled, The Key to Freedom.
There were soldiers in the streets and cannon in the valleys. The Civil War was on. Some said it started when Mad Ed Ruffin fired the first gun on Fort Sumter. You said it started when the first slave was brought to Jamestown. Some said it would end when the rebels were beaten. You said there would be no end until the slaves were free. You told that to the tall, tired man in the White House. You made a proposal. President Lincoln listened, looking out towards the river.
Mr. Douglass, you propose first that I arm the slaves. And then that I make this war a war of liberation. Emancipate the slaves. Is that it?
Essentially.
Then I'm afraid you won't like my answer.
You don't like my proposal?
My likes won't dictate my answer. You've been a leader for 20 years in the fight to free the slaves. I know of your own life in slavery. I know how you hate it. I'm with you on that.
Then can't you see the war as a war of ending the slave?
I see the war in only one way, Douglass, as a way to preserve the Union, not to save or destroy slavery. If I can save the Union without freeing the slaves, I'll do it.
You'd settle the war and leave the slaves untouched?
If it wins the war, I will. Your other requests, too, I've got to turn down. The Union is against arming the slaves. Our enemies say we're waging a war of abolition. We're only waging a war to bring the Union together again.
But, Mr. President...
I know how you feel about this. My feelings I hold to myself. You know that some countries in Europe want to recognize the Confederacy, not us. If they did that, we'd be lost. The border states threaten to go over to the Confederacy if we liberate the slaves. Your enemies in the North would split from us if we abolished slavery. We couldn't win, Douglass. Those are the keys to victory. One bad turn and we lose a Union it took 100 years to build. You had other proposals?
They're useless without freedom. I'll be going.
This puts us on different sides of the street.
It does. Except, one last question. If you could save the Union only by freeing the slaves, would you do that?
I would. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking maybe we're not too far apart. Slavery's a cancer. If it's not cut out of the nation, the Union will die.
If my cabinet believed that, we'd do it. That's not the key as we see it.
It's the one I see. Suppose I visit your cabinet members. Maybe I could prove it to them.
You left the tall, tired man and you talked to the officers in his cabinet. You had a key that could turn the Union into a fortress slaveholders couldn't touch. You talked to the chiefs of staff. You talked to the Secretary of War. He'd already heard of you.
You want to know what I think of your proposals, Douglas?
I think I've got an idea already.
I'll give it to you in black and white. Clerk?
Yes, sir?
Hand me a copy of the new instructions to our ministers.
Right here, Mr. Seward.
This, Douglas, answers your questions about how the war will end. We're sending it to every government in Europe. It's written so it'll convince even you that we mean to stand by it. Shall I read it?
If you will.
This is our policy. To whom it may concern, no matter how the war ends, the status of no class of the people of the United States will be changed by the rebellion. The slaves will be slaves still. The masters will be masters still. Shall I finish it?
Go on.
If any attempt is made by the slaves or their allies to gain their freedom, the Union Army will suppress it with an iron hand. That's our policy hereafter, Douglas. Would you like a copy of it to print in your paper?
You crushed the copy in your hands, and you walked towards home. You walked through crowds, but you were alone. You passed men milling on the streets, bewildered over the war. You heard some mutter as you passed.
Sure, I'll fight for the Union, but I ain't enlisting to fight to free no slaves.
What's the difference? Ain't fighting fighting?
Freeing slaves ain't fighting. It's foolish.
I don't see it that way.
Well, this here Lincoln's gone too far. The war's a mistake. Come to terms with the Confederate States, I say.
That's sense. Let the South have the slaves. Let us alone.
We ain't fighting to free the slaves. Then why are we sending the boys off to fight?
Because of guys like him, that's why.
Who are you talking about?
Him walking around free and easy. He's the cause of it. Look at him.
Yeah, let's show him.
Come on, guys. Get him. Come on. Catch him.
You ran through the streets that had been free to you for 20 years. You ran from men who thought they could be free only when you were in chains. You ran and your heart was sick. You ran home to your print shop to Anna and your sons. They had been waiting to print your story.
Hey, Louis, George, get some water.
Dad, what happened to you?
Your coat's bloody, Dad.
What's the matter? Who did it?
Now, boys, stand away and let your father alone. He'll talk whenever he's ready. Sit here, Fred.
I'll be all right. Are the papers ready?
One edition, Dad. We waited for you to set up the headline story.
Did you see the president? You see Lincoln?
Boys, let him alone. He needs rest. Can't your eyes tell you what happened? You needn't ask. There are mobs roaming the streets, hating what the war's about. They've been after your father. You'll stay in and rest now, Fred.
Never mind, Anna. I'm all right. I'll write my story. Lewis.
Yes, Dad?
Set the type. Let the new edition go out this evening.
And the story?
It'll be about the war. Headline it, "To Save the Union, Free the Slave."
Is that what the president said?
That's what I say. That's what the people will learn.
Was Lincoln the way you thought he'd be, Dad? Was he for freeing the slaves?
Not now.
Well, then what good is he to us? Is that the president you preach for people to vote for? Is that the man you lost your friends to fight for?
Lewis, before you judge, listen. It's true he doesn't see the war right yet.
Then he's no different from the others.
He is different. He has a way of reasoning and sort of looking squarely at things. And he's free from prejudice. When a man's free from prejudice, it's not hard to show him his mistake. We've got the key to change him. We'll use it.
You watched the soldiers marching southward, but they brought back few victories. You knew men fought best when they believed in what they fought for. Some cried the war was about states' rights, but you knew a stronger cry on the ground, the cry of freedom for millions of people. You watched the soldiers march south, and in the morning, you decided to go with them.
I'm going down to the army camps, Anna. I can't say how long I'll be gone.
I heard you.
I don't want to leave you and the boys, but someone's got to go into the camps and report to the people why we're losing the war. Some of the generals know me. I can talk to them.
If you couldn't influence the president, how can you influence the generals?
If the state's policy toward the slaves is a right one, I won't be able to. If it isn't, we can report it.
Lewis, George.
Yes, Father?
Yes?
You go on printing the papers as before. Print the stories I send back and keep the paper going.
They tried to stop us from delivering.
Deliver them anyway. Spread them as far as you can. I'll write what they're saying in the camps in Florida, Carolina, and Virginia.
Are you taking me with you, Dad?
Oh, it's too dangerous for a boy just grown.
Your time for danger will come, Lewis. Be ready for it. It's more important now that you deliver every paper we print.
Then you followed the soldiers. You saw how the war was being fought and lost. You talked to officers and men in camps facing Confederate armies. You wrote down what the general said in his tent while rebel cannon cut through the night.
Yeah, we lost the battle of Bull Run and we're losing this one. Why? Answer's simple. We need men, men, men.
Confederates outnumber us?
No, not that so much. The rebels have got slaves. Slaves are made to build their garrisons and fortifications. Slave labor allows them to put every fighting man in the field. They didn't have that.
There's a way to take it away from them, General.
What are you hitting at?
General Butler.
I said not to interrupt me.
I know, sir, but they're coming into camp again. We can't drive them off, sir.
You've got to drive them off. You know the orders.
Some of them won't go, sir. Not without...
Without shooting? Well, then shoot.
Yes, sir. I'll tell the guards.
The enemy? Coming through our lines?
Oh, no. Keep your seat. It's not the rebels he's talking about.
Well, who, then?
Fugitive slaves. They escape by the hundreds now. Sometimes they come in bringing their masters' guns along. They swarm over into our lines, taking up with us.
And you drive them back?
I've got to. Sometimes I don't know if we're fighting the fugitives or the rebels. Sometimes I think if we gave them guns, took them in...
What would happen?
Well, I know what would happen. General Fremont declared all slaves free after his first victory in Louisiana. The president reversed it. They called him down for it. I don't take any chances. I send them back, even if I have to send bullets after them.
You told that to the people through your paper. You went deeper into the lines of the army and told them of the colonel who went to war with one army and came back with another.
Your army has changed colors, Colonel. How did this happen?
I've brought back a full regiment, sir.
You left New York with white troops. You come to my camp 6 months later with black troops.
When we attacked at Baton Rouge, our men were shot up.
Shot up men don't change colors and march back.
I sent for reinforcements, sir. None came. The Rebs were attacking us on all sides. None of us expected to get out alive. We didn't have men enough to dig trenches. Then the fugitives came in.
You remember your orders about them?
Yes, I remember the orders, sir. And I also remembered we'd all die if we didn't get help. We took them in and gave them guns. They manned the trenches. When the battle was done, I'd lost most of my original regiment. So I trained the fugitives. 4,000s of them.
Your orders were to send them back to their masters.
As I said, sir, there are 4,000 out there with guns. They'll fight on our side or against us. I want them on our side.
You saw the staggering armies filled with fugitives. You saw some beaten and thrown back in hell for their masters, but still they kept coming, fighting their way from the slaveholders. And the men in the army were changing. You heard a guard say,
"You want my story, mister? They put me on guard to push back the fugitives, but I don't do it anymore. I let them come in. They come in garbed in rags or in silks, in shoes or no shoes, families and singles, and I take them in. I don't tell the general, but I take them in."
You talk to fugitives with their borrowed guns, walking along the roads, living outside the camps. You wrote of the night you walked along the road with an old ex-slave carrying his own gun to join a Union skirmish. You ask him about the war.
Somehow I'm not much worried about how the war turned out. We come into the camp, they drive us out. But when there's too many of us, they can't. I've been in tin rage yet they say I ain't a regular army man. They say the war ain't for freedom. And what they shooting about? They say when the war's over, they send me back to the old master. But I see when a man get a little freedom, he never forget the taste of it. Oh, sir. Let them say what they want. I got a feeling how the war coming out. Yes, sir. Couldn't give you that feeling.
You sent back the words of a woman who had led the Underground Railroad, who was leading scouts for the Union Army. You talked to Harriet Tubman, who'd been in a dozen battles. She told you how they were.
First, we see the lightning. That's the guns. And then we hear the thunder. That's the big guns. And then we hear the rain falling. Those are the drops of blood falling. And when it's time to take in the crops, it's dead men we reap. You tell your paper, Douglas, we're gonna reap freedom out of this, or there'll always be thunder.
You put her words down so your sons could print them and carry them to the people at home. You put down the words of fugitives and generals, officers and men who wanted to find a way to make the war worth fighting and the Union worth saving.
Tell them we can't win a war against the fugitives and the Confederates. It's got to be one or the other, Douglas. One or the other.
Tell them back home, Douglas, that 1,000 freedmen on our side is better than 1,000 slaves helping the rebels.
Tell them we've stopped driving them out of the camps. Tell them we're changing our mind about what the war is for. Tell them we're changing our mind.
And you took the words to the papers and to the tall man in the White House. He called you in and listened.
You've made a good report, Douglas.
What are you going to do about it, Mr. President? We're not winning the war.
No, the war's not going well. We've been careful not to make a false move, but I believe I know a mistake when I see one. I'm ringing for the Secretary of War and his aide. They've read the reports. I'll put it up to them.
Could you ring, sir?
Yes, tell Seward and Mr. Johnson to come in. Tell them Douglas is here.
Yes, Mr. President.
My cabinet never agrees with me, but the facts and figures that you've shown me are pretty stubborn things, Douglas. If this policy is not holding the Union together... Do you want me, Mr. Lincoln?
Has General Grant reported yet, sir? What's happened?
It's not Grant's report I want to discuss, gentlemen. It's Douglas's.
Oh,
you,
Douglas.
Yes, you've read it. You know how the war's going. I am thinking, gentlemen, that we've made a serious blunder in not taking Negro troops into our ranks. You know why we can't do it, Mr. Lincoln.
Well, we'd lose support in the border states, Mr. President. They'd be right.
Without them, we're losing the war. And that's what I'm concerned about. I know we've got thousands in the North who have no idea of the real meaning of the war. No one was prepared for it. Our manpower's dwindling. You know how seriously. Gentlemen, I am thinking of asking Douglas to help recruit as many regular Negro regiments as he can. Slave regiments, sir?
That would never work, Mr. President.
Our best commanders are already working them. They're ahead of us. Thousands are already fighting on our side. We're late in recognizing the value. There'll be 100,000 deserters if slaves come officially into the army. Then we'll replace them with 100,000 fugitives. Mr. Douglas thinks the Union will never prosper unless their labor and strength are turned to our side, and I agree. Mr. Douglas thinks we can never win without emancipation.
He'll be demanding that next.
He's demanded it already, gentlemen. The cause of the Union comes first. We started the war with no intention of touching slavery. Yet slavery is the root and kernel of the war. It's not free men alone who'll determine whether we'll have a union. It's 4 million slave workers now on the side of the Confederates trying to get to our side. Our side's holding its own, Mr. President. A few setbacks it's are not... It's not the setbacks that have decided me. It's plain arithmetic. With the labor supply the Confederates have got, we wouldn't win even if we sacrificed every white man in the North. Our chance is that the future with the fugitive slaves and the slaves behind the enemy lines. Hereafter, we'll welcome them into our ranks. I'm asking Douglas to start recruiting their regiments. I believe regiments of trained freedmen will have an unusual effect on the nerves of the slaveholders. It'll be our strongest blow.
You went out to build up the strongest blow.
You went to the platforms and halls and spoke to the fugitives and freedmen. You talked to those who had been driven out of the camps. You asked them to come back. You spoke in the streets and they listened.
Freedmen, slaves, fugitives, the hour is coming when the United States will be a land ruled not by one race, but by one people. When the first shot was fired on Fort Sumter, I said it would liberate every man in America, as well as save the Union. Till now, they fought the effect of the war without touching the cause. Hereafter, we strike at its roots. Join the fight. Forget the past. It's now or never. Better to die free than live slave.
You urged 50,000 to join the regiments, and you went home to write your paper, and you found you had recruited two men you hadn't counted on. Anna was home running the paper alone.
Anna?
Where are the boys?
Wasn't it enough to send others to fight? Did you have to send our sons?
Louis, George, they've gone.
I didn't wait for you to come back and join the new regiment.
I see. They've done right.
They were the only children I had. You know the rebels' law against them. If they're captured, they're hanged.
Don't talk that way, Anna. What I said for others, I meant for my own sons, too. They'll be fighting to free us all.
Isn't slavery still the law of the land?
We're changing that, Anna.
Who'll change it?
It's a changed thing already. The war's changed it. Lincoln will see to that.
He's given his word that he won't touch slavery.
He's given his word to save the Union. The only way to save the Union now is to strike down slavery. I think Mr. Lincoln will see it. Now let's see our sons off to war.
You saw your sons march off in the new regiments of General Putnam. You watched them go, and you went back to your printing press to make it clear what the war was about. You told the people what you saw in the war.
We're fighting for something incomparably better than the old Union. Freedmen, fugitives, we're fighting for unity of ideas, unity of sentiment, unity of object, in which there shall be no North, no South, no East, no West, no black, no white, but a solidarity of the nation, naming every slave free and every free man a voter.
You told those who still doubted the war's end.
Whether men so call it or not, the war for the Union is the war for emancipation. There'll be freedom for all or chains for all.
And you told them about Lincoln.
You can trust this man from Illinois. He may be slow, but he's not a man to retract or retreat. When he moves forward.
While men fought for the idea of one nation or two, the president invited you to call on him. You told him,
I prophesy doom if we go on with slavery, Mr. Lincoln.
And I'm beginning to believe you're right, Douglas. There's pressure to make peace now, but it would put the bondsmen back further than they are.
Would it save the Union?
After a fashion. We're not winning the war, Douglas. We still need more troops, more volunteers. We need workers to raise food for the armies and man the factories. Those you recruited weren't enough. Can we get more?
Yes, we can recruit more.
You know how many?
3 million more. 3 million more new citizens. With an Emancipation Proclamation, the trickle of fugitives will become a flood. Emancipation, that's the key to winning the war and uniting the nation. Even the Confederate generals seek laws to free slaves. Now, if the Union Army calls for emancipation first, the rebels can do nothing but surrender. You can tell your cabinet that. They have the key to crippling the Confederacy. The key is freedom. Proclaim it.
I may. When the reports come in from the field this week, when I've had time to think this through further, it may be done.
Mr. President.
Yes?
A message came in from General Putnam's regiment, sir.
Yes? What is it?
It's been nearly wiped out at Fort Wagner, sir.
Fort Wagner's soldiers wiped out?
Yes. That's what the general said.
I'd like a pass to visit the grounds. My sons were in that regiment.
Yeah, I'll give you the pass, Douglas. When you come back, maybe we can finish our talk about the key to the Union.
You left, and you forgot the fight to free 3 million people. You stumbled through the battlegrounds looking for signs of two sons. In the morning, you found one. Wounded, feverish, it was Louis. He couldn't see.
Louis, do you know me, son? I'm your father.
You, father?
Yes, we're taking you home. The doctor says you can go home now.
But what did Lincoln say? You never told me.
Lincoln hasn't said yet, son. But I believe when you're well again, you'll be in a free land.
You moved about the fields and swamps and found your sons and worked in the camps and helped dig the trenches until the enemy was stopped. Then you came home and were going back to your press and printing when the president called you late at night. He'd been up writing. He said,
"My friends say I'm slow, Douglas. My enemies say I move too fast. I wanted you here tonight because we'll move faster than we've done in 100 years.
Yes?
I have a proclamation.
Does it free the slave?
It saves the Union. Your proposals were right, Douglas. No human power can stop the war without emancipating the slaves. Even my cabinet can see this now. Shall I read the proclamation?"
And he took the thin paper with words strong enough to free millions. And he read,
"I, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, by virtue of the powers in me vested, do this first day of January 1863 proclaim that all persons held as slaves within the state in rebellion against the United States shall be henceforward and forever free. And upon this I believe to be an act of justice warranted by the Constitution, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God."
And you folded the paper and went home to your printing. There were still soldiers in the streets and cannon in the valleys. But you knew the war was won. It was the beginning of a nation of free people.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free.
Just heard Destination Freedom's dramatization of the story of Frederick Douglass, brought to you by the Chicago Defender.
Okay, that was Destination Freedom, Episode 6, The Key to Freedom. Original air date on that was the 1st of August, 1948. That was written... Excuse me. I guess it's not nice to listen to... hear your notes in the background. That's what somebody told me once. It was written and created by Richard Durham for WMAQ. It was briefly sponsored 13 episodes by the Chicago Defender, then an all-African-American newspaper in Chicago, obviously. And then it became a sustained show for the remaining season and a half, meaning no sponsorship. An all-African-American repertoire company, and written and created by an African-American, Richard Durham, unprecedented at its time. So there you have it. Destination Freedom. What we're going to do is we're going to check back in on this All-Star game, and then Madeline's going to take over. We'll have another PSA here in a second. Thanks for listening. This is Arthur.
of the American and National League with the American League up at bat with gear interrupted at the plate, and here's Tom Manning. Roy, just about set to go now. Sherman is behind the plate umpiring. Sherman of the National League, you know. George Moriarty of the American League is at third. Rick Owen is at first. And Dolly Stark is at second base. Dolly Gehring has stepped into the batter's box. Here's the windup. The great Paul Hubbell and the first ball pitch. It's a foul down first base. Strike one. The ball is received over there by Robert Johnson, manager of the Cleveland Indians. And was delayed for a moment. The ball got away from Walter and Bill Perry, manager and first baseman of today's game, finally receives the ball and tosses it back to the National League dugout. Now ready to go again. Gehring up, you know, strike one. Ball, it's a fastball, misses the outside corner of the plate, just a little bit too high. That one was not quite as fast as the first ball that Hubbell tossed in there. Or the ball one and strike one on Charlie Gehringer, you know, that great second baseman of the Detroit Tigers. Here it is. Ball two. Another hook ball. Misses the outside corner of the plate. Hubbell stood there, bending down for a moment, looking in. Well, it's a ball and the count on Charlie Gehringer. Ball two and strike one. Here it is. He swings. It's a base hit. Frankie Frisch dives for the ball and foul in the center field. It's fumbled. Gehringer's grounding first, going to second. It's close to goal.
Hi, I'm Nina. I'm training today, and I'm going to read you a PSA about the dangers of distracted driving. A few facts about texting and driving. Fact one, a texting driver is 23 times more likely to get into a crash than a non-texting driver. Fact two, using a cell phone while driving, whether it's handheld or hands-free, delays a driver's reactions as much as having a blood alcohol concentration at the legal limit of 0.08%. Fact three, distracted driving is now the number one killer of American teens. Fact four, this has been a public safety message from StopTextStopWrecks.org and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
402. The first pitch is a ball outside. Strike swinging. Heine Manning was not getting on that one. He swung from all the way back, and the count on Heine Manu, the second man up in the first inning. Ball one and strike one. Charlie Gehringer on second base, nobody out. The pitch, it's a ball. Heine Manu taking almost a half swing. Gabby Hartnett turned around, pointed his finger to the umpire with the ball in his hand, but the umpire had called it a foul. So the count on Heine Manu, a left-hand hitter, is ball two and strike one. Here's the pitch. He swings, he misses. Strike two. Heine Manu's been taking a long cut at that one. Undoubtedly, he has his eye on that right field. Please hear at the fall of ground, which is 294 feet from home plate. And about 15 feet high.
Another grand hour is in the can, as they say in the cinema world. But this is radio. This is Arthur, listening to 91.5 FM, WMFO. We had two trainees this morning, Madeline and Nina. They'll be back next week, the weather's permitting. And up next, Wake Up Sleepyhead with Marco. Thanks for listening again. So long.